welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you, is stunned to look at the calendar and find the holiday season is upon us. Really? Before you and I meet again for next week's show, we will have survived Black Friday. Not sure what your Opry Thanksgiving traditions are, but if they include waking up pre-dawn to fight for a parking spot at the mall, I'm offering a more sane alternative. I've shopped around, and this week's show is filled with great ideas for diverse ages, interests, and tastes. I hope you'll agree as we turn to page one of the book report. As Nicholas Sparks opens his new bestseller, The Longest Ride, Ira Levinson is in trouble. At age 91, alone and in poor health, he finds himself stranded on an isolated embankment after a car crash. As he struggles to retain consciousness, a blurry image materializes, his beloved wife Ruth, who had passed away 9 years earlier. Urging him to hang on, she forces him to remain alert by recounting stories of their life together. A few miles away, at a local rodeo, a Wake Forest College senior's life is about to change. Recovering from a recent breakup, Sophia Danko meets a young cowboy named Luke, who bears little resemblance to the privileged frat boys she meets at school. As she and Luke fall in love, Sophia finds herself imagining a future far removed from her previous plans. Ira and Ruth, Sophia and Luke. The two couples have little in common, yet their lives converge with unexpected poignancy. Ron McLarty and January Lavoie narrate.
The world he thought he knew no longer made sense to him, and he began to change. By then he was in his late 50s, and after making me a partner in the business, he spent little time in the shop. Instead, he became a full-time Jew. He began to attend synagogue regularly with my mother. I'll get to her later. And offered financial support to numerous Jewish causes. He refused to work on the Sabbath. He followed with interest the news regarding the founding of Israel and the Arab-Israeli war and its aftermath. And he began to visit Jerusalem at least once a year, as if looking for something he'd never known he'd been missing. As he grew older, I began to worry more about those overseas trips. But he assured me that he could take care of himself, and for many years he did. Despite his advancing age, his mind remained as sharp as ever. But unfortunately, his body wasn't quite so accommodating. He had a heart attack when he was 90. And though he recovered, a stroke 7 months later greatly weakened the right side of his body. Even then, he insisted on taking care of himself. He refused to move to a nursing home, even though he had to use a walker to get around. And he continued to drive, despite my pleas that he forfeit his license. "It's dangerous," I would tell him, to which he would shrug. "What can I do?" he would answer. "How else would I get to the store?" My father finally died a month before he turned 101. His license still in his wallet and a completed crossword puzzle on the bedstand beside him. It had been a long life, an interesting life, and I found myself thinking about him often of late. It makes sense, I suppose, because I've been following in his footsteps all along. I carried with me his rules for life every morning as I opened the shop and in the way I've dealt with people. I remembered names and gave more than was expected, and to this day I take my hat with me when I think there's a chance of rain. Like my father, I had a heart attack and now use a walker. And though I never liked crossword puzzles, my mind seems as sharp as ever. And like my father, I was too stubborn to give up my license. In retrospect, this was probably a mistake. If I had, I wouldn't be in this predicament. My car off the highway and halfway down the steep embankment, the hood crumpled from impact with the tree. And I wouldn't be fantasizing about someone coming by with a thermos full of coffee and a blanket and one of those movable thrones that carried the pharaoh from one spot to the next. Because as far as I can tell, that's just about the only way I'm ever going to make it out of here alive. I'm in trouble, Beyond the cracked windshield, the snow continues to fall, blurry and disorienting. My head is bleeding, and dizziness comes in waves. I'm almost certain my right arm is broken, collarbone too. My shoulder throbs, and the slightest twitch is agonizing. Despite my jacket, I'm already so cold that I'm shivering. I'd be lying if I told you I wasn't afraid. I don't want to die. And thanks to my parents, my mother lived to 96, I long assumed that I was genetically capable of growing even older than I already am. Until a few months ago, I fully believed I had half a dozen good years left. Well, maybe not good years. That's not the way it works at my age. I've been disintegrating for a while now. Heart, joints, kidneys, bits and pieces of my body beginning to give up the ghost. But recently something else has been added to the mix. Growths in my lungs, the doctor said. Tumors, cancer. My time is measured in months now, not years. But even so, I'm not ready to die just yet, not today. There is something I have to do, something I have done every year since 1956. A grand tradition is coming to an end. And more than anything, I wanted one last chance to say goodbye.
We have just heard The Longest Ride by Nicholas Sparks. Family ties are tested and transformed in Who Asked You?, the latest from Terry McMillan, the novelist who gave us Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back. As this story unfolds, Trinetta leaves her two young sons with her mother, Betty Jean, and promptly disappears. BJ, a trademark McMillan heroine, already has her hands full, dealing with other adult children, two opinionated sisters, a sickly husband, and her own postponed dreams, all while holding down a job as a hotel maid. Taking care of two lively grandsons is the last thing she needs. This is an intimate look at the burdens and blessings of family. The richly textured characters are brought to life by Carol DeSantini, Felicia Rashad, and Michael Boatman.
Is that you, Betty Jean? It doesn't look like I'm registering in her memory bank, so I decide to go ahead and let her off the hook. Warren Daniels, I was your son's seventh grade science teacher. I also doubled as a basketball coach, which is why we never won any games. It's probably this bald spot and gray hair and perhaps a little bit of a belly that might be throwing her off. It's nice to see you after all these years, Mr. Daniels. I'm here to find out why I was called and asked to come in to see you. Well, first of all, we tried phoning their mother, but the phone was disconnected, and you were listed to call in case of an emergency. Is there an emergency? Did something happen to one of my grandsons? No, nothing has happened to either one of them, but Mrs. Jenkins has been complaining about Ricky's behavior. He's being disruptive and rude, making it difficult for her to conduct her class. Is everything all right in their home? No, it isn't. Is their mother having the same type of problems she's had in the past? That would be a yes. So, does this mean the boys are in your care? They are. How long have they been living with you?
A few months.
I push my chair away from the desk and shake my foot a little because it's fallen asleep. This is how it usually starts. The grandparents are put in a position where they are often forced, mostly out of concern for the well-being of their grandchildren, into substitute parenting, and it's usually because the parent has fallen prey to the lure of drugs. It's sad to watch grandparents who should be preparing for retirement take on this burden, which is exactly what it is. But they do it so that their grandchildren don't have to be raised by strangers. Well, I say, pushing my chair back, Luther, as you probably know, is an excellent student, and he doesn't appear to be displaying any negative behavior. Ricky, on the other hand, has been quite a handful, and our counselor, Mrs. Barlow, has done her best to work with him, but to no avail, which is why she asked that I reach out to you.
Exactly how is he being disruptive?
Well, when Ms. Jenkins calls on another student, Ricky interrupts and yells out the answer. He likes to clown, do things to get attention. He's also not being very polite. He told Ms. Jenkins to kiss his you-know-what.
He said what?
I wouldn't make this up. He seems to be having a hard time sitting still. We see this kind of behavior all the time in children whose parents were drug users. Have you been able to maintain his medication regimen?
Well, Luther has been handling it since it appeared that this was just one of his responsibilities. But I'm not sure if he's run out. He hasn't said anything.
Although Luther is a very bright little boy, Betty Jean. Forgive me, may I call you Betty Jean?
Well, it's my name.
She chuckles a bit, which helps make this easier. Good. As I was saying, Luther is only in second grade, and notwithstanding how bright he is, this is still quite a lot of responsibility for a child his age.
I agree. I'll start giving it to him myself. I did refill the prescription.
Then perhaps Ricky's dosage might need to be reevaluated. After all, he is a growing boy. Our school psychologist thinks it would be in his and everyone's best interest if he were retested.
Okay.
Do you have temporary custody of your grandchildren?
You mean, have I been to court or something?
Yes.
No.
So, are you aware what this means?
It means I'm taking care of my grandchildren until I can figure out what else to do.
Have you been in touch with anyone from the Department of Social Services?
No. I've been thinking about it, but I wanted to wait until I had a better idea when my daughter might be coming back.
That was Who Asked You by Terry McMillan. Millions of us have read Bill O'Reilly and historian Martin Dugard's Killing Kennedy and Killing Lincoln. The new title from the pair details events leading up to the murder of the most influential man in history. In the new title, Killing Jesus, A History. The book, performed by O'Reilly, takes readers inside the life of Jesus, recounting the seismic political and historical events that made his death inevitable and changed the world forever.
The child with 36 years to live is being hunted. Heavily armed soldiers from the capital city of Jerusalem are marching to this small town, intent on finding and killing the baby boy. They are a mixed-race group of foreign mercenaries from Greece, Gaul, and Syria. The child's name, unknown to them, is Jesus, and his only crime is that some believe he will be the next king of the Jewish people. The current monarch, a dying half-Jewish, half-Arab despot named Herod, is so intent on ensuring the baby's death that his army has been ordered to murder every male child under the age of 2 years in Bethlehem. None of the soldiers knows what the child's mother and father look like or the precise location of his home. Thus, they need to kill every baby boy in the small town and surrounding area. This alone will guarantee the extermination of the potential king. It is springtime in Judea, the peak of the lambing season. The rolling dirt road takes the army past thick groves of olive trees and shepherds tending their flocks. The soldiers' feet are clad in sandals, their legs are bare, and they wear the skirt-like terugis to cover their loins. The young men sweat freely beneath the plates of armor on their chests and the tin bronze Attic helmets that cover the top of their heads and the side of their faces. The soldiers are well aware of Herod's notorious cruelty and his penchant for killing anyone who would try to threaten his throne. But there is no moral debate about the right and wrong of slaughtering infants, nor do the soldiers question whether they will have the nerve to rip a screaming child from his mother's arms and carry out the execution. When the time comes, they will follow orders and do their jobs, or risk being immediately killed for insubordination. The sword's blade is how they plan to dispatch the babies. Each soldier is armed with the Judean version of the razor-sharp pugio and gladius preferred by the Roman legions, and wear their weapons attached to the waist. Their method of murder, however, will not be restricted to the dagger or sword. Should they wish, Herod's soldiers can also use a skull-crushing stone, hurl a baby boy's off a cliff en masse, or just wrap their fists around the infant's windpipes and strangle them. The cause of death is not important. What matters most is one simple fact. King of the Jews or not, the infant must die. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, King Herod gazes out a palace window toward Bethlehem, anxiously awaiting confirmation of the slaughter. In the cobbled streets below him, the Roman-appointed king sees the crowded bazaars where vendors sell everything from water and dates to tourist trinkets and roast lamb. The walled city of 80,000 residents, packed into less than a single square mile, is a crossroads of the eastern Mediterranean. With one sweep of his eyes, Herod can see visiting Galilean peasants, brightly dressed Syrian women, and the foreign soldiers he pays to wage his battles. These men fight extremely well, but are not Jews, and don't speak a word of the Hebrew language. Herod sighs. Back in his youth, he would never have stood in a window and worried about the future. A great king and warrior such as he would have ordered that a bridle be thrown over his favorite white charger so that he might gallop to Bethlehem and murder the child himself. But Herod is now a man of 69. His massive girth and incessant medical problems make it physically impossible for him to leave his palace, let alone mount a horse. His bloated face is wreathed in a beard that extends from the bottom of his chin to just below his Adam's apple. On this day, he wears a royal purple Roman-style mantle over his short-sleeve white silk tunic. Normally, Herod prefers soft leather leggings that have been stained purple. But today, even the gentlest bristle of fabric against his inflamed big toe is enough to make him cry out in pain. So it is that Herod, the most powerful man in Judea, hobbles through the palace barefoot. But gout is the least of Herod's ailments. The king of the Jews, as this non-practicing convert to the religion likes to be known, is also suffering from lung disease, kidney problems, worms, a heart condition, sexually transmitted diseases, and a horrible version of gangrene that has caused his genitals to rot, turn black, and become infested with maggots. Thus the inability to sit astride, let alone ride, a horse. Herod has learned how to live with his aches and pains, but these warnings about a new king in Bethlehem are scaring him.
That was a sampling of Killing Jesus by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Dan Brown, as we know, is the author of numerous number one best-selling novels, including The Da Vinci Code, one of the best-selling novels of all time. In 2005, Time magazine named Brown one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Many credit him with keeping the publishing industry afloat and spiking tourism to whatever city he writes about. The son of a mathematics teacher and a church organist, Brown was raised on a prep school campus where he developed a fascination with the interplay between science and religion. He's a graduate of Amherst College and Phillips Exeter Academy, where he later returned to teach English before turning his attention to writing. Today we'll speak with him about his newest blockbuster, Inferno. Welcome, Dan. It's a thrill to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, the pleasure's mine. Thanks for having me.
Inferno features the population apocalypse equation. One can only assume the subject scares the hell out of you. Tell us about it.
Well, you're right. The subject does scare the hell out of me. We, in the last 70 to 80 years, have tripled the human population on Earth. That's one lifetime. We've tripled the population. We are headed, at least in my view, for a whole lot of trouble. And, you know, one of the things about writing books that are so labor-intensive is that I've got to choose a topic that fascinates me, and in this case, frightens me, and so I stay interested in it.
Right. How real is genetic germline manipulation?
It's absolutely real. It's funny, for the research of this book, I ended up talking to a bunch of geneticists, and I kept saying, well, can we do this? Can we do that? And finally, one of these guys said, look, the genetic toolbox is so powerful now that we can do absolutely anything. The only barriers to entry are really ethics and money. So We have some pretty important ethical questions to ask ourselves in the coming years when it comes to genetic engineering.
Oh, boy. Now, do you ever worry that your readers take all of your writing as gospel truth and they don't or can't separate fact from fiction?
I don't, because the books are novels. I think readers are smart people, and they understand that the characters are fictional and the action's fictional. And at the same time, I feel like it's important that these characters move through a landscape that is real. For example, all the locations are real. The science is real. The ethical issues are real. I don't actually, this surprises people, but I don't read a lot of fiction. I read nonstop, but it's almost exclusively nonfiction. Because I like to learn, and that's I think why my fans enjoy these books, is that they're fun, fast-paced thrillers, but you also learn a little bit about the real world along the way.
Right. How do you research the science in your book? It's so intriguing.
It's funny. I have found through the years that there is no substitute for talking to specialists. I mean, you can read books, you can look online, whatever it is, but all of my best information comes from people who are leaders in their field, and it turns out people are always eager to talk about the things that they know about. And so it's never any trouble to find a great geneticist who's dying to sit down and tell you about his business.
Well, you know, that's one thing that's so amazing about your books, is that you make the science accessible to those like myself who are not scientists.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. That's one of the hardest things I do, because, you know, in the case of this book, I didn't know a lot about genetic engineering before I started researching the book, and I had to learn it to a point where I could distill it such that I could understand it, and in hopes, you know, other people, lay people like myself, could also understand it.
Right. Okay, the city of Florence features so prominently in Inferno. How much time did you spend there, and how did you research both the political and the art history?
Well, I spent quite a bit of time there on three separate trips, and was fortunate to make contact with some terrific curators and terrific historians who let me into some places that realistically I wouldn't have gotten into had I not been writing the follow-up to the Da Vinci Code in some ways, in their mind at least, another book set in Europe. It really is a question of finding the right people who will tell you the more interesting information, the stuff that you don't see in the history books and the stuff that you don't see just on the regular public tours.
Well, I recently visited Istanbul, and I spent some time in the Sunken Palace after reading Inferno, and Inferno really captures the place. How much time did you spend underground?
That's a funny question. I guess from the descriptions, it sounds like I spent a lot of time there. I don't think I spent more than an hour there, because I, like Langdon, am a little bit claustrophobic.
Oh.
And I was down there, took a whole lot of notes. I even took recordings of the space. The acoustics in the space were interesting to me, and so I have recordings of the acoustics in the space, lots and lots of photos and videos, and then I couldn't wait to get back above ground. And I think some of my discomfort with being down there helped fuel the writing of those scenes that I hope feel a little bit oppressive.
Yeah. I have a girl question to ask you now. Not a question, but a comment. Your thrillers usually team Robert Langdon up with incredibly smart, resourceful women, and I want to thank you for that. Tell us a little about this book's Sienna Brooks.
Well, in general, I write smart, interesting women because I find them much more interesting. I married one. And Sienna Brooks is she has a very, an exceptionally high IQ. She's sort of an outlier in that sense, that she has a very, very powerful mind, and at a very, very young age learned this and was ostracized because of it. And so in some ways it's her greatest asset, but it's also her Achilles heel, that she has some sort of social issues because of her sort of hyper-intelligence. And of course, it's a great foil for Langdon. She knows a lot about medicine and genetic engineering, and of course, he knows very little. And so, in their conversations, Langdon is teaching her about art and history and Dante, and she's teaching him about genetics. And in the process, the reader's learning about both.
Hmm. Well, without giving away any details of the book's ending, this ending is very different from other books of yours. What has reader response been like?
You know, I was very, I wouldn't say I was nervous, but I was very curious what would happen when this book came out. And I'm relieved to say reader response has been terrific. I what you're hinting at here is that the book is not as tied up and as neatly a package as my previous books. There definitely is resolution, and it's definitely a satisfying ending, and yet there's a little bit of an ellipsis at the end, a dot, 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 wondering what happens next. And a lot of readers have written and said, well, I can't wait for the sequel. So we'll see if that happens or not.
Wow. Well, speaking of sequel, do tourist boards of every major city in the world beg you to set a story in their city?
You know, it's funny you say that. Places like Paris and Rome and Florence are world-class cities and don't need me to spark their tourism. At the same time, these books and in some cases the movies generate a huge influx of tourism. And yes, I do get a whole lot of beautiful books from the heads of different tourism bureaus saying, you know, look at Andorra, isn't it beautiful? Or look at the Czech Republic, or look at, you know, come visit us. Look at a lot of places in South America would love for me to come. So I have to find a location that has a story built into it.
Well, have you chosen a location for your next book?
I can't possibly tell you.
Oh!
No, it's all very secret.
All right. I often wonder, can you write Robert Langdon now and not envision Tom Hanks? Does he embody your earliest vision of Langdon?
You know, it's funny. The answer is no. I don't. I love Tom Hanks. He's terrific. We're very, very fortunate to have him playing Langdon. But I spend so much time with the Langdon that I created in my mind. And I spent a lot of time, many, many years with that Langdon before a movie was made. So the quantity of time that I spend with my own personal Langdon is so much more than I spend, seeing the movies, that I really don't cross that line. I'm sure for readers, many of them do cross that line, and that's fine. But for me, no, I've got a very specific Langdon in mind.
Is there an inner Langdon in you?
Well, Langdon's a whole lot smarter than I am. He lives a much more exciting life. But certainly there's some crossover in that there's a lot of intellectual curiosity. There's some questions about religion and history and a love of adventure. But I guess that's probably where the similarities lie. It's funny, somebody asked me a similar question. I said, well, Langdon's a lot smarter than I am. And this woman kind of said, well, how can that be? Because everything that Langdon says, you had to think of. And I had to explain to her that, you know, when Langdon walks by a painting and gives an off-the-cuff, brilliant, synopsis of what the painting is symbolizing, you know, that took me 3 days to write. So, there you have it.
All right. And is there a movie in the works for Inferno, and are you involved?
Yes, there is a movie in the works. Everyone at Sony and Imagine and, Tom Hanks, and everybody is very, very excited about Inferno. It's a very visual, for those who've read the book, they'll know that it's an exceptionally visual, high-stakes drama. It will translate well to the screen, and they are working very, very hard on the script, which I'll see soon. And I am involved in the movies. Clearly, I know the books, arguably better than anybody else. At the same time, I'm not a filmmaker, and I would never presume to tell the likes of Ron Howard how to make a movie. So. I chime in here and there, but for the most part, I leave it to the professionals.
So do universities now feature courses on symbology because of you?
I've actually heard that some do. Yeah, and that's terrific. And, symbols like music and mathematics are a universal language, and they transcend language, they transcend culture. And if nothing else, I think part of a well-rounded education would be to understand the importance of symbols in our history, in our lives, and in our, science and our religion, all of that.
Have you heard about groups that are now, like, reading every word of Dante's Inferno and trying to get the code?
Yes, I have, actually, and nothing makes me happier. I wrote Inferno with the... there is no prerequisite to have read Dante before you read Inferno. I figured most of the people who come to this sort of mainstream thriller will not have read an epic poem from the 1300s. And yet, part of my hope with writing the novel was that people would say, wow, the Divine Comedy sounds like a pretty interesting piece of literature. Maybe I'll go give that a look. And it sounds like a lot of people have.
Oh, all right. Well, any final thoughts for readers?
Well, I hope that people enjoy the book. It's kind of a book with a... I've heard that it... that it's got a little bit of something for everybody. There's so much art, there's so much action, and there's also a lot of science. And on top of it all, there is a very profound ethical question about where we are headed as a human race, where the planet's headed. This isn't an activist book, and yet it does raise some pretty important questions. And I hope that readers engage on them and debate them.
Well, Dan, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, the pleasure's been mine.
All righty. Bye. Okay, I promised diversity of titles on this show, so I'm going way out of my usual selects to bring you Happy, 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 My Life and Legacy as the Duck Commander by Phil Robertson. This no-holds-barred autobiography chronicles Phil's remarkable life, from early childhood through the founding of his incredibly successful family business. An NFL-bound quarterback in the 60s, Phil made his mark at Louisiana Tech, playing football and completing his college career with a master's in English. Phil soon found himself on a path to self-destruction, leasing a bar, drinking too much, fighting, wasting his talents. Then, following a calling from God, he invented a duck call that would change everything. With great love for his country, his family, and his maker, Phil found the ingredients to the good life. He shares the narration with Al Robertson.
Not everyone likes to eat. These little chicks today are starving themselves to death, which is kind of ironic, but it's their choice. Since you have to eat to live, you're left with a dilemma. You can choose not to learn how to cook and just eat slop, and you'll stay alive. You can live off terrible cooking, which doesn't taste very good, but you'll somehow manage to survive. But my contention is that if you have to eat anyway, it just seems to me that you're shortchanging yourself if you don't learn how to cook. If you have to eat, why not learn how to eat well? Of course, the downside to eating well is that if you eat too much, you can't get through the door. Well, if that happens, you might ought to cut back some. You can overdo anything, and when you can't get through the door because you're too rotund, you might ought to say, I think I need to start eating a few salads. I'm not saying you should just shovel it in. I'm just saying if you learn how to cook, your stay on Earth might be more enjoyable. I learned to cook when I was young, and most of my meals started with something I killed. I have a God-given right to pursue happiness, and happiness to me is killing things, skinning them, plucking them, and then having a good meal. What makes me happy is going out and blowing a duck's head off. As it says in Acts 10:13, King James Version, and there came a voice to him, rise, Peter, kill and eat. Rise, kill and eat. That's my modus operandi. When I was young, heaven to me was hunting in the woods around our house or fishing on the nearby lakes and rivers. We hunted and threw lines into the Red River for catfish and white perch nearly every day. We didn't have much of a choice. It's where we got our next meal. But when I was in high school, we were forced to move out of the log cabin where I grew up. My Aunt Myrtle sold the farm, so we moved to the nearby town of Dixie, Louisiana. The town was a nice enough place. We lived on Main Street, just a stone's throw from Stroud's General Store, which was adjoined by a one-room post office. The general store and a cotton gin were the only businesses in town. My father hoped the change of environment would help my mother, who had suffered a nervous breakdown and needed numerous trips to Shumpert Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana, for treatment. Granny was diagnosed as manic depressive and was twice confined to the Louisiana Mental Institute at Pineville, where she received electric shock therapy, a treatment in vogue at the time. At times, my mother was almost her old self, and Paul would bring her home to be reunited with us. But her condition didn't stabilize until several years later, when it was discovered that lithium could control it. Fortunately, my mother went on to live a productive and venerated life until her death at 95 years old. Granny's illness couldn't have come at a worse time for my family. A short time after we moved to Dixie, Paul fell 18 feet off the floor of a drilling rig and landed on his head. The impact fractured two vertebrae in his back. As Paul collapsed forward, he was bent so severely that it burst his stomach. He also broke his big toe, which slammed into the ground as he doubled up. Telling us about it later, Paul said with a wry smile, "I've heard of people getting hit on the head hard enough to break both ankles, but not their big toe." The vertebrae in Paul's back were fused with bone from his hip. His stomach and big toe were repaired. But he was in a neck-to-hip heavy plaster of Paris cast for 2 years. A round opening had been left only over his injured stomach. As always, Paul met the situation in his own laid-back manner. Jimmy Frank and Harold were in college at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge at the time. They were sharing a GI Bill payment of $110 a month and supplementing their income by Harold's work at the Hatcher Hall cafeteria and Jimmy Frank's work on the LSU Horse and Sheep Unit Experimental Farm. They wanted to drop out of school and come home to work to help support the family, but my daddy insisted they stay in school, remarking dryly over the phone, "We'll make it." And we did, but not without hardship.
That was Happy, 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 My Life and Legacy as the Duck Commander by Phil Robertson. The Good Lord Bird is from James McBride, best-selling author of The Color of Water. It's the story of Henry, a young boy born a slave in the Kansas Territory in 1857. When John Brown, legendary abolitionist, arrives in the area, an argument between Brown and Henry's master quickly turns violent. Henry is forced to leave town with Brown, but here's the twist. Brown believes Henry to be a girl. Over the ensuing months, Henry, whom Brown nicknames Little Onion, conceals his true identity as he struggles to stay alive. The climax of the story finds Little Onion with Brown at Harper's Ferry on the night of the historic raid. Michael Boatman performs this absorbing mix of history and imagination.
Mr. Higgins claims Mr. Shackelford was 103 years old when the account was recorded, though he writes, "It could be more. Onion had me by at least 30 years. While Mr. Shackelford is listed in the 1942 church registry, which survived the fire, no one in the current congregation is old enough to recall him. The congregation has announced plans to pass the account of Mr. Shackelford to a Negro history expert for verification, and later sell the notebooks for publication, with the proceeds going toward the purchase of a new church van." Part 1. Free Deeds. Kansas. Chapter 1. Meet the Lord.
"I was born a colored man, and don't you forget it. But I lived as a colored woman for 17 years. My pa was a full-blooded Negro out of Osawatomie, in Kansas Territory, north of Fort Scott, near Lawrence. Pa was a barber by trade, though that never gave him full satisfaction. Preaching the gospel was his main line. Pa didn't have a regular church, like the type that don't allow nothing but bingo on Wednesday nights and women setting around making paper doll cutouts. He saved souls one at a time, cutting hair at Dutch Henry's Tavern, which was tucked at a crossing on the California Trail that runs along the Kaw River in South Kansas Territory. Pa ministered mostly to lowlifes, four-flushers, slaveholders, and drunks who came along the Kansas Trail. He weren't a big man in size, but he dressed big. He favored a top hat, pants that drawed up around his ankles, high-collar shirt, and heeled boots. Most of his clothing was junk he found, or items he stole off dead white folks on the prairie killed off from dropsy or aired out on account of some dispute or other. His shirt had bullet holes in it the size of quarters. His hat was two sizes too small. His trousers come from two different colored pairs sewn together in the middle where the arse met. His hair was nappy enough to strike a match on. Most women wouldn't go near him, including my ma, who closed her eyes in death bringing me to this life. She was said to be a gentle, high-yellow woman. Your ma was the only woman in the world man enough to hear my holy thoughts, Pa boasted, for I'm a man of many parts. Whatever them parts was, they didn't add up to much. For all full up and dressed to the nines, complete with boots and 3-inch top hat, Pa only come out to about 4 feet 8 inches tall, and quite a bit of that was air. But what he lacked in size, Pa made up for with his voice. My Pa could out-yell with his voice any white man who ever walked God's green earth, bar none. He had a high, thin voice. When he talked, it sounded like he had a Jew's harp stuck down his throat, for he spoke in pops and bangs and such, which meant speaking with him was a 2-for-1 deal, being that he cleaned your face and spit-washed it for you at the same time. Make that 3-for-1 when you consider his breath. His breath smelled like hog guts and sawdust, for he worked in a slaughterhouse for many years, so most colored folks avoided him generally. But white folks liked him fine. Many a night I seen my Pa fill up on joy juice and leap atop the bar at Dutch Henry's, snipping his scissors and hollering through the smoke and gin, "The Lord's coming! He's coming to gnash out your teeth and tear out your hair!" Then fling himself into a crowd of the meanest, low-down, piss-drunk Missouri rebels you ever saw. And while they mostly clubbed him to the floor and kicked out his teeth, them white fellas didn't no more blame my Pa for flinging himself at them in the name of the Holy Ghost than if a tornado was to come along and toss him across the room, for the spirit of the Redeemer who spilt his blood was serious business out on the prairie in them days.
That was The Good Lord Bird by James McBride. Inspired by one of literature's most haunting love triangles, Lynn Cullen's Mrs. Poe delivers a pitch-perfect rendering of Edgar Allan Poe, his mistress's tantalizing confession, and his wife's frightening obsession. 1845. New York City is bustling with new immigrants and old money, poverty and crime. Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven is all the rage. As a mother trying on her own to support 2 young children, Frances Osgood jumps at the chance to meet the illustrious Mr. Poe at a literary gathering. Although not a great fan of Poe's writing, she is overwhelmed by his magnetic presence and the surprising revelation that he admires her work. What follows is a flirtation, then a seduction, then an illicit affair. But when Edgar's frail wife, Virginia, insists on befriending Frances as well, the relationship becomes as dark and twisted as one of Poe's tales. Eliza Foss narrates.
When given bad news, most women of my station can afford to slump onto their divans, their china cups slipping from their fingers to the carpet, their hair falling prettily from its pins, their 14 starched petticoats compacting with a plush crunch. I am not one of them. As a lady whose husband is so busy painting portraits of wealthy patrons, most of whom happen to be women, that he forgets that he has a family, I have more in common with the girls who troll the muddy streets of Corlear's Hook, looking to part sailors from their dollars, than I do with the ladies of my class, in spite of my appearance. This thought bolted into my mind like a horse stung by a wasp that afternoon at the office of the Evening Mirror. I was in the midst of listening to a joke about 2 backward Hoosiers being told by the editor, Mr. George Pope Morris. I knew that the news Mr. Morris was obviously putting off giving me must not be good. Still, I laughed delightedly at his infantile joke, even while choking on the miasma created by his excess of perfumed hair pomade, the open glue pot sitting upon his desk, and the parrot cage to my left, which was in dire need of changing. I hoped to soften him, just as a hooker softens potential customers by lifting a corner of her skirt. I struck when Mr. Morris was still chuckling from his own joke. showing teeth brushed with particular care before I had to set off to confront him after a silence of 22 days, I said, "About the poem I sent you in January." I trailed off, widening my eyes with hopefulness, my equivalent of petticoat lifting. If I was to become independent, I needed the income. No sailor considering a pair of ankles looked more wary than Mr. George Pope Morris did at that moment, although few sailors managed to achieve the success he had at toilet, particularly with his hair. Never before had such a lofty loaf of curls arisen from a human head without the aid of padding. It was as if he had used his top hat for a mold. Whether by design or accident, one large curl had escaped the mass and now dangled upon his forehead like a gelatinous fish hook. "Might you have misplaced it?" I asked lightly. Maybe he would appreciate putting the blame on his partner. "Or perhaps Mr. Willis has it." His gaze slid down to my bosom, registered the disappointment of seeing only cloak, then snapped back to my face. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Osgood. To be quite frank, it is not what we are looking for." "I'm certain that your female readership would enjoy my allusions to love in my descriptions of flowers. Mr. Rufus Griswold has been so kind to include some of my poems in his recent collection. Perhaps you've heard of it?" "I know Griswold's collection. Everyone does. He's made sure of it. How that little bully got to be such an authority on poetry, I'll never know." "Threats of death?" Mr. Morris laughed, then waggled his finger at me. "Mrs. Osgood." Quickly, before I lost him, "My own book, published by Mr. Harper, The Poetry of Flowers and the Flowers of Poetry, sold quite well." "When was that?" he asked distractedly. 2 years ago. Actually, it was 4. "As I thought, flowers are not what is selling of late. What everyone is interested in these days are shivery tales, stories of the macabre." "Like Mr. Poe's bird poem?" He nodded, causing the great greased curl to bounce. "As a matter of fact, yes. Our sales soared when we brought out The Raven at the end of January. Same thing happened when we reprinted it last week. I suspect we could reprint it 10 times, and it wouldn't be enough. Readers have gone raven mad."
That was a sampling of Mrs. Poe by Lynn Cullen. Park by Rainbow Rowell is set in 1986 over the course of one school year. It's the story of two star-crossed misfits, smart enough to know their first love almost never lasts, but brave and desperate enough to try. Though this title is classified as a young adult novel, adult readers are finding much to love within its pages. Rebecca Lohman and Sunil Malhotra narrate.
Eleanor considered her options. One, she could walk home from school. Pros, exercise, color in her cheeks, time to herself. Cons, she didn't know her new address yet, or even the general direction to start walking. Two, she could call her mom and ask for a ride. Pros, lots. Cons, her mom didn't have a phone or a car. Three, she could call her dad. Ha. Four, she could call her grandma, just to say hi. She was sitting on the concrete steps at the front of the school, staring out at the row of yellow buses. Her bus was right there, number 666. Even if Eleanor could avoid the bus today, even if her fairy godmother showed up with a pumpkin carriage, she'd still have to find a way to get back to school tomorrow morning. And it's not like the devil kids on the bus were going to wake up on the other side of their beds tomorrow. Seriously. It wouldn't surprise Eleanor if they unhinged their jaws the next time she saw them. That girl in the back with the blonde hair and the acid-washed jacket, you could practically see the horns hidden in her bangs. And her boyfriend was possibly a member of the Nephilim. That girl, all of them, hated Eleanor before they'd even laid eyes on her, like they'd been hired to kill her in a past life. Eleanor couldn't tell if the Asian kid who finally let her sit down was one of them, or whether he was just really stupid. But not stupid. He was in two of Eleanor's honors classes. Her mom had insisted that the new school put Eleanor in honors classes. She'd freaked when she saw how bad Eleanor's grades were from last year in the ninth grade. "This can't be a surprise to you, Mrs. Douglas," the counselor said. "Ha," Eleanor thought. "You'd be surprised what could be a surprise at this point." Whatever. Eleanor could stare at the clouds just as easily in honors classes. There were just as many windows. If she ever even came back to this school. If she ever even got home. Eleanor couldn't tell her mom about the bus situation anyway, because her mom had already said that Eleanor didn't have to ride the bus. Last night, when she was helping Eleanor unpack, "Richie said he'll take you," her mom said. "It's on his way to work." "Is he going to make me ride in the back of his truck?" "He's trying to make peace, Eleanor. You promised that you'd try too." "It's easier for me to make peace from a distance." "I told him you were ready to be part of this family." "I'm already part of this family. I'm like a charter member." "Eleanor," her mom said, "please." "I'll just ride the bus," Eleanor had said. "It's not a big deal. I'll meet people." Ha, Eleanor thought now. Giant, dramatic ha. Her bus was going to leave soon. A few of the other buses were already pulling away. Somebody ran down the steps next to Eleanor and accidentally kicked her bag. She pulled it out of the way and started to say sorry, but it was that stupid Asian kid, and he frowned when he saw that it was her. She frowned right back at him, and he ran ahead. "Oh, fine," Eleanor thought. "The children of hell shan't go hungry on my watch."
We've just heard Eleanor and Park by Rainbow Rowell. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this first look at gift-worthy books. I'll be back throughout the holiday season with many ideas. All of us at The Book Report wish you and yours a warm, wonderful, and mighty tasty Thanksgiving. We are incredibly thankful you chose to spend time with us today and hope to see you back here next week on The Book Report.